From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether you've read it or not, you know what the novel Don Quixote is about, right? Right? There's this mad knight wandering the countryside on an impossible task, so it's about idealism, or it's about living your life in a genuine way. Well, maybe it's that. Elon Stavins says the novel's meaning for him changes. When he was a kid and first read it, yes, it was the absurd exuberance that he loved, but now in his 50s, it's different. In his own book about Don Quixote, Stavins says the novel is a middle-aged quest. As the body deteriorates, it's that noble attempt at retrieving the dreams we nurtured earlier in our lives. Today in the program, we're celebrating the 400th birthday of Don Quixote de la Mancha. Stavins will join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org. And if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's kind of remarkable that Miguel de Cervantes created the most famous literary character of all time, Don Quixote, the Mad Knight. As the scholar Elon Stavins explains, Cervantes was a second-rate poet, a mediocre playwright, but there was something about this novel that turned into an international sensation. And if you've read it, you know, and pretty much everyone does, it's about a man who reads and reads about chivalrous characters, knights in armor on steeds, riding around, righting wrongs. And he reads and reads and reads, and at some point, his brains dry up, and he creates this character for himself, another persona. He calls the character Don Quixote. And as Stavins tells us in his own book about Quixote, it's the imagination of this man alone that launches him on an adventure. As Stavins writes, isn't that what we all do in life? Find a purpose, a mission to justify our days? And maybe that's why the book remains so popular. Well, Don Quixote is 400 years old this year, and we are celebrating today with Elon Stavins. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Elon Stavins is the Lewis Sebring Professor in Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College, the author of many books, including Spanglish, The Making of a New American Language, and Quixote is the book we're talking about, Quixote, the novel in the world. He's joining us today from a studio in Pelham, Massachusetts. Professor Stavins, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to begin with an image I really liked it right at the beginning of your book, Quixote. There's this image of an asteroid, which I think kind of gives us a good – it's a nice image to give us a sense of this novel. The idea of it of wandering. Would you start with that image? The asteroid. Let me see. 3552.
3552. An asteroid that has been wandering around, aimless. At one point, when identified by astronomers, he was appropriately named Don Quixote, right, in order to place that placeness that he is all about, and the fact that he goes and goes and doesn't arrive anywhere. I love that image, that it's not only us in our mind lost in search of a dream, but maybe larger things, objects in our galaxy or the entire universe looking to justify itself.
A migrating object, a kind of imposter, an artifact, passing for something he's not, dreaming of an alternative life. These are some of the elements that make this novel so compelling for us?
Certainly. This is a novel, Doug, that that somehow has become an essential part of who we are, almost like the color yellow. You couldn't get rid of the color yellow in the universe because the universe would no longer be the same. And you can't get rid of this novel, even when we don't read it, when we don't actually open the book, we have been defined by it in one way or another. It's a novel that that built modernity with itself, the novel that taught us how a character changes not only in the outside world, but in the inside world as well. And it is the perfect classic, as far as I'm concerned, a book that, as Mark Twain once said, everybody knows, but very few people read.
Right. I want to come back to this idea of how it's really Cervantes is, along with Montaigne and Shakespeare, becomes the father of modernity, this idea of modernity. But let me ask you about your personal connection to this. It's interesting you write about how when you first read Don Quixote, you weren't really that crazy about it. It didn't really take, not that first time.
Right. I am of the conviction, Doug, that good books, lasting books, they are the ones that choose their readers and not the other way around. And that this book was alluring me, was trying to get me to be part of its adventure, but that I wasn't ready yet. And so I opened it when I was very young, and I thought it was carelessly written and it was chaotic, and I didn't quite connect with the ordeal, with the journey that the protagonist and his squire undertake. And so I jumped from one section to the next and thought that, well, you know, those classics, they are hammered on our heads, young people, by the adults, and I'm not going to submit. And yet there was something in it, something in that experience that remained in the back of my mind. And later on in life, I returned to it. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is what a great book is all about, a book that you reread, not only read. And I realized in the second time around that that there was something extraordinary here, and that it had changed, and that it was asking me as a reader to change as well. And from there on, I keep on returning to the book. It is a kind of anchor or maybe a compass that leads me to life. And often I open it at random in different sections, in different chapters, and I find wisdom. And I find myself having read different parts in the past and remembering what those parts were all about and how they meant or didn't mean something, and how now I have changed and they mean something different. So what I love about it is that it has taught me that books, good books, change, that they are transformed as we are transformed as readers. They are not static. They are in constant movement, and we have to be open to them just as they are open to us.
Yeah. I mean, when it originally finally took for you was when you had this desire to be a writer, this quixotic desire to be a writer, this pursuit that you describe in your book as vital and pathetic. So that was the thing that was the first thing that connected to you, was the thing that was going on in your life at the time. And I guess that's what novels do for us, is the thing that's happening in our life at that moment, we find that thing in the novel to connect to, I suppose.
Yes. Vital and pathetic. That dream of becoming a writer, and in my own case, having been born and raised in Mexico and into the Spanish language, and then moving as an immigrant to the United States, becoming a writer in my language, but in another language as well, in translation, so to speak. Maybe every big decision we make in life is about courage, but also about foolishness, and these are the two sides of the same coin. I wanted to be a writer like Cervantes. I didn't know yet, but that was the case. And I like the fact that he was a peripheral figure in his time. I find it ironic that today we think back of the beginning of the 17th century in Spain and describe it as the age of Cervantes, when he was really a minor figure, eclipsed, hardly anybody of stature paying attention to him. But that is the way great works end up growing not only in us as individuals, but growing in stature and in reach in civilizations themselves, and end up defining those civilizations.
Well, I think everyone knows the basic story, but let's go through it because I want to talk about some of these particular points and certainly the great characters beyond Don Quixote in the book. So there's a man, an Hidalgo, a nobleman, Alonso Quijano, lives in this hacienda in this unknown place in this region of La Mancha. This is central Spain. Take it from there. He's been spending his days reading novels of chivalry, and he's neglecting everything in his life because he's reading and reading and reading.
And reading, Doug. And what we know about him is absolutely nothing. That is one of the great assets of this novel. We are not given any flashback. You know, he had a childhood where he was miserable or where he found a desire to become this or that. We encounter him already in his 50s. His background is and will remain unknown to us. The one thing we know is that he's an avid reader, so avid that at one point, 3-4 pages into the novel, we are told that his brains dry up.
Right.
And as a result, he loses his sense of reality. He is no longer Alonso Quijano. And he becomes one of the characters that he has read, or at least a collage of many of the knights and in the chivalry novels that he has pursued. And in that sense, he's a superhero. Maybe like the superheroes that inspire so many children and young kids today. They want to be like Superman or like Batman or like Spider-Man. And from that point on, the narrator no longer describes him as Alonso Quijano. The narrator has submitted to this desire of this character to be somebody else, Don Quixote. And Don Quixote starts leaving his place of origin, his hacienda, his part of the village where he lives, and starts to dream that he can improve the world, that he can mend wrongs, that he can go out and persuade people that things are not as bad. And in that, Cervantes is immediately acute and to the point. He describes a Spain at the beginning of the 17th century that is immensely poor, mm-hmm. and yet it is one of the most important empires at the time. And in his adventures, this new knight finds a friend who is from the opposite economic end of society, a bulky laborer by the name of Sancho Panza, mm-hmm. and he invites him to become his squire and persuades him that he can go together with him and help other people. And the reason why Don Quixote wants to do this is out of idealism. He wants mm-hmm. to fix the world. But in the case of Sancho is a materialist. He yeah. simply wants some money. He wants to be compensated for all his action. And this, the pair, the couple, become lasting and really some of the two fixtures that define us as modern people.
What's so interesting about that relationship, and you write about that relationship, is at first Quixote sees himself as, well, I guess he always sees himself as the better of Sancho Panza. But they sort of trade wisdom. He gets, you say, in the end, from this relationship as much as Sancho gets from Quixote. And that's an important part of this. I think that that relationship seems to play a lot in this character of what Don Quixote becomes, sort of.
It's essential because in the end, this is not a novel about two individuals. It is not about individualism per se. It is a novel about friendship, about an unlikely friendship between two well-defined, very different men. And as they cross La Mancha and go as far as Barcelona, they help each other, and a metamorphosis takes place. There is a moment in which you realize, as a reader, that Sancho is becoming more and more like Don Quixote, mm-hmm. and Don Quixote is becoming more and more like Sancho, and that is what friendship is about. It is depositing in somebody else a part of you, and that seed will not be you anymore. It will be different. It will grow in ways that can only be shaped by that companion that you have. And that is why this novel, again, another aspect, touches readers so deeply, because it is the friendship between these two characters that ultimately makes you see that for as courageous a dreamer or a visionary you might want to be, it is with others, through others, that you can become fully human.
There is this tension that exists throughout the novel between what is real and what is imagined. And there's this moment in the relationship of Quixote and Sancho Panza that I wanted to ask you about. There's this incident in the cave of Montesinos that you write about, where Don Quixote is lowered into this cave and he falls asleep, and he says he sees wondrous things. Among them, Dulcinea, the character we'll get to, and her enchanted form. And you say in your book that he tries to convince Sancho that what he saw was real. This is real, what I saw. But then he has to come to terms with the fact that I need evidence to make this case, and he doesn't really have any evidence. So would you talk about that? I think this is really fascinating, and getting to that tension between real and the imaginary.
It is a crucial moment in the novel, Doug. This is a cave that is... This is a moment in which the character reaches down, maybe down into his subconscious or down into the underworld alone. Sancho has helped him enter the cave. The cave, by the way, is a real site mm-hmm. in Spain. And he has this almost mystical experience, this transformative vision that is very, very much his. And he has the impression that time has become plastic, that he has been able to pull it apart and see things that are truly wondrous. And then he comes out and he's persuading Sancho that the experience is authentic. Mm-hmm. And Sancho at this point knows that he might be a bit crazy, and he doesn't know if to follow his master along and simply say yes, or to try to persuade him that he was only there a few hours, that he couldn't have seen all this because in the cave there's nobody else but him. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, there is a wrestling of identities, a wrestling of personalities, because Don Quixote wants to be himself more than at any point before. And Sancho has understood the lie, but he has also understood that that lie keeps his master going. Right. And that if he takes away that lie from him, maybe his Sancho's own relationship, maybe his own vision will collapse. And as a result, you see the desire by both of them to agree, to disagree, and to remain who they are and move along. And it is a decisive pivotal moment that makes for those experiences that we have in life when we're talking to a spouse or to a child or to a friend, when we know that what we're saying is not really coming across as we wished, but we know that the person is going to agree with us out of empathy or because it would be better to do it that way rather than that make us look more foolish. And we acquiesce, and the person in front of us does too. And there's a certain harmony in the falseness that has been created that is beautiful.
And how significant is it, how remarkable is it for a novel of the 17th century to have talked about this? Because you say, well, this is getting back to the idea that this is the novel that invented modernity. Because it told us, as you said, everything is subjective, that truth is relative, and now there's an interior life and an exterior life. So this must have been a remarkable novel to have had this subject, this idea of reality as a central idea.
I think, Doug, that it was so remarkable that Cervantes himself, I have the impression, and this is a subjective impression, didn't quite understand the immensity of his discovery, so to speak, that it, the discovery of the inner life as a life that has its own laws and its own tension, and maybe is as or more important than the outside life that we lead. Remember that prior to this book, most of the literary works that were available had to do with folklore and myth. Think of the Bible or of Dante's Divine Comedy or of the Canterbury Tales, where characters are more kind of cartoonish or simply names or fictures. They don't necessarily have an inner life. The characters of the Bible are delivering statements, but we don't know what they are feeling internally. And here, Cervantes has been able to create a character that has a psychological pattern that understands his inner forces. And I would say that from that moment on, from 1605, when the first part of Don Quixote was published, and 10 years later, 1615, we have entered the age of psychology. Of the fact that our fantasy is as our imagination is as important as anything else, and that we pay attention to it. And certainly in literature, what we like about novels is the fact that they can draw us into the character's inner life, that we will see the motives, the reasons why they act in a particular way. Before Cervantes, we didn't know what prompted a character to act in a particular way. Maybe it was a higher force, or maybe it was a serendipity. Here, there is an inner drive, and that inner drive has to be explained.
Ilan Stavins is with us, a professor in Latin American and Latino culture. His new book is Quixote, The Novel and the World. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the classic novel Don Quixote. Professor Ilan Stavins is with us. He has a personal relationship to the book, and a lot of us do. Stavins says Quixote is the most famous character from a novel of all time, a man who reads about and broods on what it means to fight for the innocent in an evil world and crafts from his imagination a knight to go on adventures. Stavins' book is Quixote, The Novel and the World, and he's joining us today from a studio in Pelham, Massachusetts. He's a professor in Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College. Well, let's talk about Cervantes. It's interesting to read in your book what we know and what we don't know about the man. We know he died in 1616, April 22nd, but buried in an unmarked grave. What does that tell us?
It tells us, Doc, that he died very poor, almost unknown, and he died in a way that was closer to the paupers and the working class. He had been a soldier and had been a tax collector and had gotten in trouble as a result, and we think that he was in jail because of the misuse of certain funds. Mm-hmm. We know that he had an out-of-wedlock daughter, and that he often got into street fights. And we know that he had tried his luck as a playwright and as a poet, that he had fought in one of the most important battles for Spain at the time, the Battle of Lepanto, and lost control of his left arm. And on his way back from Italy in the Mediterranean, he was captured by the Turks and he was imprisoned in Algiers as a captive, spending there a few years before finally being able to escape. His brother was also there. The fact is, we know very little about him. If we compare him to Shakespeare, there is so little information regarding Shakespeare that people have invented alternative biographies and have suggested that Shakespeare didn't exist. We have enough or barely enough. For Cervantes, nobody has dared to suggest that he didn't exist. But maybe the fact that we know so little has enabled us not to tie his biography that much to the book. In the book, as a result, is freer from the type of the, you know, detective work that historians often want to do of why did he write this, or is this an expression of a particular incident or trauma in his childhood or in his young adulthood.
I liked the moment in the book where you write about this question of what did he look like. We don't really know, but he wrote a kind of narrative self-portrait, which does give us an idealized view of what he looked like, I suppose. Silvery beard, small mouth, really terrible teeth.
And with that almost insignificant amount of information, the amount of portraits that have been made of Cervantes is incredible. I think prove that the human imagination is boundless, because we don't have anything else, and we keep on trying to imagine how he looked, and if the way he looked would tell us something about his main character, Don Quixote, and about other aspects of the novel.
So this idea of chivalry is really important. Put that in the context of all of this, because you say Spanish civilization is really built on the myth of a knight.
Yes. Maybe the way to think of chivalry is to consider that every single age where reading plays a role has favorite genres. We today, maybe it's detective fiction or romance or science fiction. Many people at the beginning of the 17th century were crazy about knights and chivalry novels, and they would devour them. They were international bestsellers published in Portugal and in Italy and in Spain and in France. They would be translated from one language to another. Many of them had the very same basic elements. A knight who would go out to conquer a long and abandoned lands from the infidels. The chivalry novel had a very strong religious component. And there were also aspects that have to do with a lost manuscript or with a spade or a blade or a rock that had magical powers. And there was also the figure of the idealized lady to whom every action of the knight would be devoted. It was she, it was her, who would justify these adventures. And they were connected with the idea of the Crusades, of at one point even reaching as far as Jerusalem and making Christianity the center of Western civilization. And so even though Cervantes is not a religious writer, he writes in a religious time. The Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, played a major role. And there's one chapter where he comments on that role in a way that could almost be seen as defiant. And many of these elements that we today have forgotten, he turns them into a parody. This is what Don Quixote the novel is about, making fun of how people love this type of books. And here, creating a character that is an anti-hero. Yeah. A kind of a reversal of those big and powerful and epic and heroic knights that could do no wrong and who would always come back triumphant. Very often when Don Quixote goes out, he returns home beaten down. Right. He has to be put in bed. He can't move. So there's something truly humorous about all this.
And Don Quixote suffers from inner doubt. That's another thing that's really interesting about that. Sancho Panza does too. They have inner doubt. They're not successful necessarily. He's probably crazy. I mean, so that's the thing. I think this is not a book about chivalry. It's, as you said, it's a spoof. And I think that's an important way of understanding the novel, it seems.
Yes, and inner doubt, Doug. Aren't we all always about that in how we handle our doubts and how we try to hide them or become honest and bring them to the fore? Don Quixote goes along frequently fighting that inner doubt and trying to convince himself that he is who he is. But as a reader, you're never fully sure if he is pulling our leg, if he's pretending to be Don Quixote, or if he truly is. Every single character around him, including Sancho, tries to convince him that he can get out of this lunacy, mm-hmm. that he can return to being Alonso Quijano, and everything is going to be all right. And he resists it. But at the very end of the book, he finally agrees, and he gives up this dream. And then everybody else, this is one of the great moments in literature, everybody else tells him, please, don't give up that dream, because if you give it up, then what will we, the rest of us, have? We have been dependent on that dream. You have persuaded us that without that dream, we are nothing. And so you have this kind of reversal of roles, he returning back to reality, and everybody around persuaded that we need a little dose of irreality in order to go on.
There's this, the role of the Inquisition I wanted to ask you a bit more on. People have this impression that Cervantes was, and maybe it's because of the movie, I don't know, Cervantes is in jail, that his book is a response generally to the Inquisition. Not necessarily true, you say, but it doesn't really matter. But what is the role of the Inquisition in all of this? And there is also this question I wanted to ask you about whether Cervantes was Jewish. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about that part?
Sure. Two very pertinent questions, Doug. The first one, if we go back to the beginning of the 17th century, we have to think of the role that the church, the Catholic Church, is playing, that it controls and defines everything. For any book to be published, the manuscript had to be submitted to the censors, to the inquisitors, for them to read it and approve it or not, and then it would reach a larger readership. Larger in that context, because a bestseller in Cervantes' time was only about maybe 1,500 copies. Today, that is nothing. Mm-hmm. But the 1,500 copies of the book took a long time to sell, we know that. And yet, at a time when few people read, it became very popular because people went out to plazas on the street and read portions to others who didn't, who were illiterate, and who fell in love with this book. The Inquisition, there were Inquisitions in most European countries, in England and in Italy and in Portugal and in France, but none had the bad name that the Spanish Inquisition eventually acquired and the relationship that Inquisition had with the state. There is a moment early on in the book when Don Quixote finally comes back after his first outing, and he's beaten up and he is in bed and trying to recover, when the priest in the village, and who's a friend of Alonso Quijano, and the barber, also a friend of Alonso Quijano. And these are two emblematic and symbolic characters. They represent the church or faith and science or the way of looking into more systematized and rational knowledge. Enter both of them, his personal library, and start looking at each and every one of the titles, thinking that if they expurgate that personal library, that Alonso Quijano is going to come back from his madness. Mm-hmm. And so they go one by one and decide if they are going to throw that book out the window, to burn it, right, or to keep it. And that what is fascinating is that it allows us to see that the inquisitors were rather well read and almost like literary critics. They could be able to say, this is a good writer. I read other books by him. This is not his best title, but let's give him a chance. Mm-hmm. And the other question that you asked me, the one about Jewishness, again, at the time of the early Renaissance, when the novel was written, there had been in Spain the coexistence of the three major Western religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. This is a time that in many ways we it's a mirror that we should be more interested in, where the three of them could coexist. Today it seems that there's a big tension among them. And Spain had, in 1492, expelled the Jews. Right. And eventually also expelled the Muslims and coalesced again around Christianity as the unifying national force. Many people that were Jewish had to hide their identity. And we think that Cervantes's family had some Jewish blood and that they had to hide it. And there might be an indication in this, in the fact that precisely at the beginning of the book, we don't know anything about the character, and that not even the town of La Mancha is named. Maybe a sign that Cervantes is placing here, that the past should not be emphasized, that it's better not to talk about it, that we should only go into the future or to live in the present. He might have had crypto-Jewish, that is, secret Jewish blood. He might certainly have been part of a new Christian family. And in the Hispanic civilization, if you had Jewish blood, you could be singled out and you could be ridiculed. So the new Christian families had to struggle in order to cover up that ancestry if they wanted to remain in Spain and not leave the country and go to the Americas or to the Balkans or to the Mediterranean. Again, we don't know that much about Cervantes, but maybe the book has hidden clues where he is tacitly sending us messages of what he doesn't want to say. I think a great novel is a novel not only for what it says, but a novel for what it doesn't say.
I wanted you to read that those first lines, if you would, because, as you said, they hide as much as they reveal about the identity of Quixote or Quijano. Would you read it in Spanish first and then English? Do you mind?
With pleasure. En un lugar de La Mancha, de cuyo nombre no quiero acordarme, no ha mucho tiempo que vivía un hidalgo de los de lanza en astillero, adarga antigua, rocín flaco y galgo corredor. In a village of La Mancha, the name of which I have no desire to call to mind, there lived not long since one of those gentlemen that keep a lance in the lance rack, an old buckler, a lean hack, and a greyhound for cursing.
Yeah, you just have an inkling of, and then we move on, right? I mean, that's the whole idea. Like, we're not going to deal with the backstory. Here's what we know, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's one of the, you know, one could think of five or six great first lines of novels, Dickens and Nabokov and Flaubert. And this is one of the greatest. Maybe Melville, too. This is one of the greatest. This is a line that is so powerful that you can only write a great book after it.
Ilan Stavins is with us. We're talking about his book, Quixote, The Novel and the World. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Professor Ilan Stavins. We're talking about Don Quixote. It's 400th anniversary of that great novel. And Stavins has a book of his own called Quixote, The Novel and the World. And he's joining us today to talk about it. Alonso Quijano is crazy? Because you ask a very particular question about that. Is he a madman? What kind of madman? What are we talking about in the context of, like, mental illness?
Mm-hmm. Was Nelson Mandela a madman? Was Che Guevara a madman?
Right.
Don't you have to be a madman in order to have big dreams and be able to implement them in society, in reality? It is a novel about mental illness. It is about how mental illness is part of all of us. and it's about the very delicate, very subtle line that separates that which we believe in and that which is real. It's very difficult to prove the difference, and that delicate line, I guess, is where we live our lives.
A lot of the book, of course, your book, deals with the how it is this book took off and became such an international success. A lot of it, and I want to talk about the role that it played in America, the founding fathers who thought so much about this book. We'll get to in a moment, but let's ask a little bit or talk a little bit about its role in Latin American politics too. Because you mentioned the military defeat, for example, of Spain against the British. This was in 1588. This was before, of course, Cervantes writes this book. But that's important to understand because the idea of loss is baked into this book. And it seems like that has to have said something about the influence of this book in the Latin world. Is that right?
Yeah. I love the word you use, baked into it. It is. It's about defeat, and it's about what we do with defeat and how we accept or not that defeat. The Hispanic world, after the collapse of the Spanish Armada, after the slow, agonizing decline of the Spanish Empire, has been about defeat, the defeat of the Americas, the colonies there, vis-a-vis the triumph of the United States, and the defeat of forces for change, often in civilian life, that have been crushed by military governments. I don't think it's an accident that we in the Spanish language and from there on to other languages have turned the name of the character, the Don Quixote, into an adjective. Mm-hmm. We are quixotic. We have to remain dreamers. When I think of Latin America and the population, I think that we might not always be good politicians, but we are great dreamers. Proof of it is in the great novels that we have produced, in the fabulous poetry, in the enduring stories that we tell through a variety of means. And that has much to do with the way we have had to go deep into our dreams in order to face a world that has been cruel and has been mean and disorganized. And in the quixotic, as a result, is in the DNA of our culture, particularly, in my view, in the DNA of the culture of Hispanic American. If we focus in the United States, well, you have here, on the one hand, the great American dream, the possibility that you start at the bottom and you can convince others that you have talent, that you have genius, that you have the resources to climb up, to become a different person, that you don't have to be stuck in the segment of society where you came to life. Or, as in George Washington and Hamilton and the Jefferson, that you can create a new nation from the start in a new landscape, and that nation can supersede the ideas and ideals of old and recalcitrant Europe, that here people can be free, religiously free and politically free and socially free in a way that can become an envy to others. And a country of immigrants, where the immigrant dreams of a better life in another language, in a place, in a village of whose name he often can't remember, or she, and ultimately persuades everybody else that she or he is part of this new reality and it's better that way. I think immigrants are very quixotic.
George Washington, you said, so this is the, as you put it in the book, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, they all read Don Quixote. They loved it. This was their guidebook to exceptionalism, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when signing the Declaration or the Constitution, some of them had copies next to them, or they had just read the book before that day or that week. And we have it in America, that the book has been a friend, a companion of the great writers and the great dreamers. Mark Twain couldn't have written Huckleberry Finn without it. And if you think of the runaway slave and of the little boy, they are Don Quixote and Sancho. And if you think of Ernie and Bert in Sesame Street, or you think of C-3PO and R2-D2.
Or George and Lenny?
And George and Lenny, these are the two companions that are really a variety, a vicissitude of what Don Quixote and Sancho are all about.
I want to ask you about this big question about what it's about. I mean, this is what we've been talking about. But you say that the novel isn't about enlightenment. Quixote isn't searching for revelation. So give us a sense of what it is he's searching for, because you say the book is about an exploration of the place where our inner and our outer worlds meet, that there are two dimensions, I guess. And so is that why this book resonates so much, is we see those two dimensions of our own characters?
Yes, I think that this is the easiest book to reduce to a summary and the hardest really to its content to be conveyed. And that is why it is so malleable, and that is why so many people see it from so many different perspectives. It's really the story of two modest men, one thin, one fat, one tall, one short, one an idealist, the other one a materialist, who are just going from one town to another talking. And just talking. This is what the book is about, how conversation can sustain us and transform us. But it is about much more. It is about how each of them sees the world differently and how each of them have a level of fantasy that clashes with how they process the world. And ultimately, it is a book about the episodic nature of life and how things constantly change depending on how we see it. And the reader is drawn to it. And as a result, that reader finds all sorts, like in the Cave of Montesinos, his or her own mystical experience, and realizes that the book, you can't really put it in three or four sentences. The book is about much more. The book is larger. Maybe the book contains us all and we're characters in it.
I have to say, it's so sad when Quijano at the end repents of his sins and refutes these grand illusions. And I'm wondering what Cervantes is actually telling us there. Because as you say, everyone wants Quijano not to give up Quixote. But is Cervantes, you also write that Cervantes is cautioning people not to get out of control. You know, beware of following your dreams. Because even though they might set you free, that freedom that you get is illusory. So what is ultimately Cervantes telling us about dreams, about following your passion, really?
Doug, it would be foolish and maybe misguided of me to tell you or our listeners what the book is about, because I have spent an entire life trying to figure it out, and I am sure I'm going to go to my grave having questions and doubts and uncertainties. I can tell you this much at this point in my life. This is a book that Cervantes claims to be his. Maybe he announces at the very end, when the character recants his dreams, that death unifies us and homogenizes us all, that in the end, the journey all comes down to non-existence, that we come to the world the way we will leave it. And it is what we do here and now, and not anywhere else, that really matters. But it is also about him realizing, him being Cervantes, that other people have become already infatuated with Don Quixote and Sancho, his characters, the ones he created, and that if he doesn't make the character recant and insert that famous line in the very last chapter. Don Quixote was born for me and me alone, and I and him will always be together, that maybe people will steal it away, that others will turn Cervantes, Don Quixote into a knight again, that he will go out. And mind you, that's exactly what we've been doing.
Yeah.
Everybody's stealing from Cervantes and creating a new version of Don Quixote. So it's both an invitation to say this is mine and also a recognition that what's mine at this point really belongs to everybody.
You tell this great story in your book about this trip you took to Japan, and you stumble upon this store supposedly dedicated to Don Quixote. And then you walk in, you're all excited, you think they're going to be, you know, action figures and books and banners and all kinds of things. But it had nothing connected to the novel in there. And you're trying to figure out so you wander around the store trying to break this code. Would you tell that story? I think it's really sort of, it tells us a lot about, think about the way we encounter this book.
Yeah, I go around because the name of Quixote is the name of the store, and I think finally I will enter this Hall of Mirrors, this castle where everything has become an aspect from and of the novel, and there's nothing in it. It's tchotchkes and the items that really don't have anything to do with the book. Somebody has just stolen the title of it and used it as a corporate name. And I realize at that point that, well, that's exactly what this is all about. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be looking for Don Quixote and Sancho to find him because they are everywhere. And in the very last sections of the book, I wrestle with the concept, who is trapping whom? Am I trapped in this dream of finding the quixotic everywhere I go? Or has Cervantes and his characters trapped me in the book? And I am at their mercy. And either way, it's a good, simple, devout life. It is wonderful to me to find a classic that will become your friend and that will tell you things you don't know, even though you've been hearing them often along the way.
Ilan Stavins, his book is Quixote, The Novel and the World. He's a professor in Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College. He joined us from a studio in Pella, Massachusetts. Professor, thank you very much for the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Lindsay Vickers is our intern. Josh Weathers is the producer for Video West. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.